I think women make much better cops than men because they're willing to use this and this, your mind and your mouth, before they're willing to use this. I think it's all about listening. When we were negotiators and on the SWAT team, you know, we used to get credits like, nice job, you talked that guy out. What we really did is listened the guy out. One of the things that team sports taught me was the importance of being part of something that's bigger than yourself. I got to a point where it was like, this sucks, but I'm gonna have to embrace this suck. You know, I don't like these cards, but these are the cards that I've been dealt, and I'm gonna have to play them to the best of my ability. And I've been trying to do that for the last 10 years.
Welcome to Respond to Resilience, along with my co-host, Bonnie Rumeli, LCSW EMTB. I'm David Dashinger. In this episode, we'll be speaking with Terry Tucker. He's a former SWAT team hostage negotiator, also an author and cancer warrior, and he's the founder of Motivational Check, LLC, about the four truths to leading your uncommon and extraordinary life. Catch all our episodes by liking and subscribing to our YouTube channel, Respond to Resilience. We're also on Facebook, Respond to Wellness, Inc., BBSradio.com, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, all the podcast platforms, and our website is ResponderTV.com. You can see all the past episodes there and get guest information. We'll be back to speak with Terry right after this. In this family, more of us die by our own hands than by the hazards of the job. In this family, up to a quarter of 911 dispatchers have symptoms of PTSD. In this family, our mental health and wellness are in crisis while responders are quietly suffering. In this family, many struggle with job-related stress, burnout, trauma, sleep disruption, substance abuse, and marriage problems. In this family, we can help the helpers with vital information and resources, resilience strategies, and success stories of overcoming the obstacles. In this family, no one is alone. Welcome to Respond to Resilience with co-hosts retired Lieutenant David Dashinger, Dr. Stacy Raymond, and Bonnie Rumeli, LCSW EMTB. So we're very pleased to welcome Terry Tucker to the show, and we'll tell you a little bit about Terry. He's a motivational speaker, an author, an international podcast guest on the topics of motivation, mindset, and self-development. He has a business administration degree from the Citadel, where he played NCAA Division I basketball, and a master's degree from Boston University. In his professional career, Terry has been a marketing executive, hospital administrator, SWAT team hostage negotiator, high school basketball coach, a business owner, motivational speaker, and for the past 10 years, a cancer warrior, which resulted in the amputation of his foot in 2018 and his leg in 2020. He's also the author of the book, Sustainable Excellence, 10 Principles to Leading Your Uncommon and Extraordinary Life. Welcome to Respond to Resilience, Terry.
Well, thank you, David. Bonnie, I'm looking forward to talking with both of you.
It's nice to have you.
Thank you.
So let's dive right in. Of course, we want to hear about the hostage negotiations as well. but wondering, how did you get into law enforcement in the early part of your life?
Yeah, it really wasn't in the early part of my life. I was a 37-year-old rookie police officer, which by most accounts would be considered old to be getting in that line of work.
Very unique.
And there actually kind of is a backstory, because David just mentioned that my first two jobs were in the corporate headquarters of Wendy's International in the marketing department and as a hospital administrator. And then I made the pivot to law enforcement. The backstory of that is that my grandfather was a Chicago police officer from 1924 to 1954. So he was in Chicago during Prohibition, when alcohol was outlawed in the United States, during the Great Depression, the late 20s, early 30s, and when the gangsters, Al Capone and those guys, were shooting up the town. Wow. And he was actually shot in the line of duty with his own gun. It was not a serious injury. He was shot in the ankle, taking a homicide suspect back to the lockup. But my dad always remembered the stories that my grandmother told. And my dad was an infant when this occurred, of that knock on the door of, Mrs. Tucker, grab your son, come with us. Your husband's been shot. And let's be honest, trauma medicine in 1933 was a whole lot different than trauma medicine was today. So when I expressed an interest in wanting to go into law enforcement, my dad was, absolutely not. You're going to go to college. You're going to major in business. You're going to get out, get a great job, get married, have 2.4 kids, and live happily ever after. But that's what my dad wanted me to do. Mm-hmm. That wasn't what I felt my passion or my purpose was. Mm-hmm. When I graduated from college, my father and my grandmother were both dying of different forms of cancer. And so I had a choice to make. I could say, sorry, Dad, you know, I'm going to go blaze my own trail and go into law enforcement, or out of love and respect for you, I will do what you want me to do. So I sort of joke. I did what every good son did. I waited till my father passed away, and then I followed my own dreams.
And what was it like for you to be a 37-year-old rookie? Was it what were the you know, advantages and disadvantages?
I took a lot more Tylenol in the police academy than the younger recruits did. In a way, it was good for me because having had that life experience, having had something to fall back on, I think made me a better police officer. I was able to talk to different kinds of people and talk about different things. So I was very glad that I did those years in business and in hospital administration. But it was just something I was supposed to do. It was something that I think the stars aligned and I think God put it in my life that you're going to do this. You may not do it as early as you want to, but eventually I think you'll get to it. And I did. And I never lost that dream. And I never got to a point where, you know, I was willing to settle where, you know what, I'm in business and, you know what, I'm not getting any younger, so I might as well just settle for this. Mm-hmm. I wasn't willing to settle. I knew this was what I was supposed to do. And so eventually I got to the point where I did it.
So powerful, too, like to pursue that dream. Having been in the music business, you hear a lot of stories about people that, you know, I wanted to go into the music business. I had this talent, but, you know, I just decided not to pursue it. And I think it in a way, it can be kind of a pain that you carry with you for maybe the rest of your life. So kudos for making that choice.
You know, you remind me of that saying, life isn't always on time, but it's always in time.
Yeah.
You know, like it came at the time where it was probably supposed to for you to come with all of that back knowledge. And I'm actually wondering how law enforcement tapped into your strengths and abilities as a person, because by the time you're 37, you've sharpened a lot of those things.
You have. And I was lucky in that regard. And I also had a very strong support system. My wife married me when I was a suit and tie, 8 to 5, Monday through Friday hospital administrator. And when we got married, we moved to California. And I just happened to see this circular that came in the mail from Santa Barbara City College that said, if you take this class, you can apply to be a reserve police officer with any agency within the state. So you can imagine how that went at dinner that night. It was like, hey, hon, I kind of like to do this. What do you think? And so she was incredibly supportive. I took the class. I got on with Santa Barbara PD. And so I was a customer service manager for an academic publishing company at the time. So I would go to work all week. And then on Fridays, I'd come home, put on my uniform, go to roll call, work all night, and then come home Saturday morning. And if my wife was here, she would tell you, she said, you would come home exhausted, but with this incredible smile, this incredible grin on your face. And she was like, I knew that was what you were supposed to do. So when our daughter was born and we moved to Cincinnati, I looked at her and I'm like, look, I've got the bug. I want to do this full time. And she supported me in doing that.
It certainly is a bug, right, David? I think we both had it.
Yes. And sometimes it's also like, you know, that open door, right? In my case, we happened to buy a house next to a firehouse and one thing led to another. So it became a career path.
When it comes to occupational cancer exposures, members of the fire service are some of the highest risk professionals nationwide. Firefighters Against Cancer and Exposures, also known as the FACES Foundation, is an advocacy organization established to bring awareness, resources, and peer support to responders in need of additional help in battling potential cancer diagnoses or critical concerns. The FACES Foundation was established by a national alliance of first responders to offer supplemental resources for firefighters. One of its core initiatives is cancer awareness in the form of prevention and early detection, supporting vigilance about occupational cancers and cancer recurrence through our national Get Checked Now campaign. Also, the FACES Foundation publishes a major public catalog of resources for the many areas of need, including information on clinical and mental health therapies, benefits and compensations, funding sources and financial strategies. For more information, please visit the FACES website at facesusa.org.
Terry, some of the challenges you faced as a law enforcement officer, like, can you talk about those a little bit, the skills that you had and maybe some that you had to develop in on the job to meet some of those challenges?
Yeah, I mean, I get people that, not as much anymore, unfortunately, but I used to get people who reach out saying, I'm interested in law enforcement. What do you recommend? And I always used to tell them, put your devices down. Go out on the street and talk to the homeless guy. You know, go up to the penthouse and talk to that guy. Because if you can talk to people, especially in law enforcement, you know, so much of it, you know, people ask me, like, you know, what's it like? I said, well, think about it this way. You make less money than a plumber. Nobody wants you there and everybody lies to you. Now, if that was your job every single day, how long would you do that job? And, you know, people look at it like, well, I wouldn't do that job. So, well, that's what a police officer is asked to do, or a sheriff's deputy, or whatever you want to call it, is asked to do. You make less money than a plumber when nobody wants you around. I mean, with you guys, the fire department, everybody loves you. You know, when you show up, it's great. It's never a good thing when the police show up. It's, you know, you're pulling somebody over to give them a ticket. You're knocking on their door to tell them, hey, you need to call a hospital. Grandmother died and they can't get a hold of you. Whatever it is, it was never a good thing. And then everybody lies to you. You know, everybody's trying to get their side of the story so that you believe that and you take the other person to jail. So you definitely need to know how to communicate with people. If you can't communicate, you're going to be incredibly unhappy in that job. You also may get hurt or get somebody else hurt. So I think the other thing that I found interesting, and I'll never forget this, you know, when I was in Santa Barbara, I got out of that course I was telling you about. My first day on the job, I go to roll call. I'm getting ready to meet my training officer. I'm expecting some, you know, old, crusty, burly guy, you know, with kind of a cigarette hanging out of his mouth. Come on, kid, I'll tell you how to do this. And I get this very quiet, petite, demure woman. And I'm like, really? You're going to teach me about law enforcement? She was the best law enforcement officer I ever met. She was smart. She was tactically sound. She was safe. She was the whole nine yards. And I was like, boy, talk about being a chauvinist. I was like, what an idiot you were to think that only men could teach you how to be a cop. I had a partner for a number of years in Cincinnati that was a woman. And I think women make much better cops than men because they're willing to use this and this, your mind and your mouth, before they're willing to use this. And I never wanted to fight anybody. I'm 6'8", 240 pounds at the time. So I didn't get many fights. Even drug-induced people didn't kind of want to take me on. But why somebody would come on that job to sort of, you know, kick butt and take names, it's like you're going to get yourself hurt and you're going to get other people hurt. So come on the job because you want to make a difference. You want to help your community. Don't do it because there's some kind of bravado going on in your life.
You said something interesting, and it makes me want to ask, how much, in your opinion, of police work is listening? Like, if it was 100%, how much is listening and how much is talking to be an effective officer?
I think it's all about listening. I mean, when we were negotiators, you know, on the SWAT team, you know, we used to get credits like, nice job, you talked that guy out. What we really did is listened the guy out. And that's, you know, and we can talk more about that, but it was really listening to what's being said, what's not being said, and how it's being said. And if you can kind of pick up on those nuances and realize, that's not what a normal person would say. I mean, you know, kind of going back to investigation and interrogation with people, it's like, well, what do you think should happen to somebody that molests a child? Well, somebody that is guilty a lot of times will be, well, you know, they should get help and they should, you know, somebody that's innocent would be like, you should cut their testicles off and hang them from a tree. The emotion that comes when you're innocent, as opposed to, you know, you're guilty and you're trying to downplay it and sort of remove yourself from the situation, was pretty interesting. And if you could pick up on those nuances about what people were saying or what they weren't saying, then you could kind of take that investigation a little bit further.
It sounds like that skill is so important, but also for all of us in our professions to listen. I think we all probably talk a lot more than we should and don't listen enough. You know, I see that in my office. I see it with couples. It's across the board. So it would be amazing to see how much more effective we could all be as first responders if we honed that one skill.
It would. And you know, and we used to use a lot of what and how questions. And it's so funny. Last week I was in treatment and I had one of these, one of the nurses was with me. And she asked me, I forget what we were talking about, but she asked me a what question. And I just kind of started laughing and looked at her like, are you trying to negotiate with me? She's like, no, I'm just trying to understand what's going on. But it was...
Well, you must have to develop almost like a street level psychologist approach to what people are saying or not saying and the information. Like, I think responders really are information gatherers, and the better you can distill that information into what's important and what's relevant, better you can do your job.
Oh, absolutely. And fire department's the same way. You know, what aren't people telling you that, you know, you're looking at their heart rate or blood pressure or something like that. It's like, wait a minute, that doesn't make sense based on what you're telling me and things like that. So, I mean, it's not just law enforcement. I think it's first responders that sort of need to key into what people are saying or what they aren't saying. And again, a lot of times how they're saying it or what they're saying and how that's coming across to other people. Well, that doesn't make a lot of sense. And, you know, a lot of times if you're under the influence of something, you don't make a lot of sense, but just trying to put that puzzle together, whether it's, you know, fire department, paramedics, law enforcement, it really is a lot of times sort of about the hunt, you know, about putting the case together, about figuring things out and putting the puzzle pieces in the right place.
Yeah, absolutely. And I would add to that dispatchers, right? They're really, that's their whole job is getting the pertinent information and disseminating it to the units responding.
I can't imagine, at least for us being a dispatcher, you know, I mean, we're there, we're involved in the situation. They're somewhere else listening to what's going on and, you know, sort of on the edge of their seat. I mean, they are absolutely the unsung heroes. I mean, the more information they could give us, the better we could react to what happened when we got on scene, but they didn't know, you know, and especially you come on the radio asking for help and they're trying to raise you and, you know, you're involved fighting with somebody and they can't. They are definitely the unsung heroes.
And I would argue the best listeners of all of us.
Oh, absolutely.
For sure. I wanted to ask you about a term that you use, motivational check. What does that mean?
Motivational check was a phrase that was given to us in the academy by our defensive tactics instructor. And it was a phrase that, and this guy was, you know, he actually went and trained with the Navy SEALs. So it gives you an idea of kind of how out there this guy, I mean, we ran a marathon. We did all kinds of things in the academy to get us ready. He was amazing. But he gave us that phrase, motivational check, as a way of, just, you could just yell it out at any time you wanted. If you were just, you know, I'm having a tough day. I'm sore. I'm tired. I can't get through this. And we would respond with our class number. We were the 84th recruit class in the Cincinnati Police Department Academy. And just to let the person know, it's, hey, you're not alone. We're all hurting, but we're all going to get through this together. And that was just a phrase that was used all the time with people when they were just having a tough day. And when I started my blog, I was like, well, what do I call this thing? And motivational check just seemed to be the right thing at the right time.
Yeah, I like it. It just clicks very well.
It's like a mantra. Mm-hmm.
It is. Yeah.
Terry, let's shift gears and talk a little bit about your 10-year cancer journey and how has cancer changed you?
Yeah. Let me kind of just sort of, I'll give you the high points, if there are any, of this journey. 2012, I had my own school security consulting business. And I was a girls' high school basketball coach. We were living in Texas at the time. And I had a callus break open on the bottom of my foot, right below my third toe. And initially didn't think much of it because as a coach, you're on your feet a lot. But after a couple weeks of it not healing, I made an appointment and went to see a podiatrist, a foot doctor, a friend of mine. And he took an x-ray and he said, Terry, I think you have a little cyst in there and I can cut it out. And he did. And he showed it to me. It was just a little gelatin sac with some white fat in it. No dark spots, no blood, nothing that gave either one of us concern. But fortunately or unfortunately, he sent it off to pathology to have it looked at. 2 weeks later, I received a call from him. And as I mentioned, he was a friend of mine. And the more difficulty he was having explaining what was going on, the more frightened I was becoming. Until finally, he just laid it out for me. He said, Terry, I've been a doctor for 25 years. I have never seen this form of cancer. You have a rare form of melanoma, which most people think of as a skin disease because of too much exposure to the sun. But you have this rare form of melanoma that appears on the bottom of the feet and the palms of the hands. And because it's so rare, he recommended I go to MD Anderson Cancer Center, probably one of the best in the country at treating all kinds of rare cancers. And so I did. And that started my 10-year odyssey. I was on a drug for 5 years that gave me flu-like symptoms. David, you mentioned, you know, I had my leg amputated. I had my foot amputated. I still have tumors in my lungs, which I'm being treated for now. So it's certainly been an interesting journey. And I think I went through all the stages that we would associate with grief. You know, first it was denial. It's like, no, I can't possibly have cancer. And then I was, you know, I get mad. It's like, no, I've done everything right in my life. This can't possibly be. And then, you know, you sort of bargain with God. And our daughter was in high school when I got cancer. It was like, look, just let me live long enough to see her graduate from high school. And then you get to a point where you, I think you get down a little bit. And then, at least I did, I got to a point where it was like, this sucks, but I'm going to have to embrace this suck. You know, I don't like these cards, but these are the cards that I've been dealt, and I'm going to have to play them to the best of my ability. And I've been trying to do that for the last 10 years.
Well, listening to you is so inspiring. You know, I know what you're saying about it being such a struggle and being such low points for you, but it sounds like you're a very resilient person. You were able to tap into all of this strength that you built over the course of your life to help you navigate this.
I have. I've been very lucky. I started playing basketball when I was 9 years old, and I got a scholarship to college and played all the way through until I graduated. And I think one of the things that team sports and at least for me it was team sports. I think it can be any team, whether you know you're with your colleagues, whether it's your family, what you're in a business, whatever it is. But I think one of the things that team sports taught me was the importance of being part of something that's bigger than yourself. You know, you realize on a team that if you don't do your job, not only do you let yourself down, but you let your teammates down, your coaches down, your fans down. And if you think about it, the biggest team game that we all play is this game of life. So I look at my cancer journey. I'm on a clinical trial drug now that more than likely is not going to save my life, but it may save the life of somebody 5 years from now, 10 years from now, based on the data that the doctors are gleaning from my blood tests and my scans and things like that. So, you know, it's one of those things where I think we all get to those points where, you know, do you grab the handle of have to or grab the handle of get to? And when I go to treatment, I hate it, but I get to go to treatment because I look at it as it's something that's bigger than me that might help somebody else down the road.
You know, Terry, I'm wondering, when you were at that helpless point, what pulled you out of that? Like, what thought? Because I think there's a moment and a crossroads from what I understand people describing it as. And I'm wondering, when you were at that crossroads, what did you draw on to pull yourself out and to have hope again?
I talk about my three F's, and those are faith, family, and friends. I have a very strong faith in God, always have. When I was on the interferon, the drug that I mentioned for 5 years, there was a point, you're right, where I was hopeless. It was helpless. It was like, I am so sick of being sick. I prayed to die. And God didn't obviously take me, but then I prayed for, then you better give me the strength to help me get through this. And I believe that he did. And the second part is my family. It's my wife and daughter and I, And kind of a funny story, it's a funny story, but it really did happen this way. When I had my leg amputated, my doctor wanted to put me on chemotherapy. And I looked at him, and I'm like, is it going to save my life? And he was like, probably not, but it might buy you some more time. And I was 8 years into this cancer odyssey. And so I said, well, I don't think I want to do that if the outcome is going to be the same, but I'll go home and talk to my family. So I go home and I start talking. And our daughter was in college, but she happened to be home at the time. And I started talking. My daughter's like, wait a minute, family meeting, family meeting. There's three of us. It's not like we got a board here or something like that, you know? So we sit around the kitchen table and my wife and daughter and I individually talk about me having chemotherapy. And then when we're done, my daughter's like, all right, let's take a vote. How many people want dad to have chemotherapy? And my wife and daughter raised their hand. I'm like, wait a minute, am I getting outvoted for something I don't want to do? But I remembered back when I was in the police academy, and our defensive tactics instructor used to have us bring a photograph of the people we love the most to class. And as we were learning different techniques to defend ourselves, we were to look at that photograph because he reasoned you'll fight harder for the people you love than you will fight for yourself. So I ended up taking chemotherapy, not because I wanted to, but because my family wanted me to, and I love them more than I love myself. So that's sort of the family story. And then friends, I think it's interesting with the number of people that I thought would be there for me when I got cancer that were like, I can't deal with this. You know, I can't, whether it's me projecting, you know, that's going to be me at some point in time down the road. I don't want to deal with that now. Or just they couldn't deal with the potential I was going to die. I planned my funeral. And some people were like, we can't talk about that. We don't want to talk about that with you. We're uncomfortable. So I'm like, okay, I'm good with it if you want to talk about it. But so, you know, you really kind of find out who's going to be in that foxhole with you when the shooting starts based on how things are going. And people who I thought would be with me aren't. And people who I didn't think would be with me are in that foxhole with me.
Wow. So many things to touch on there. And one of them is, you know, in my own personal cancer journey, I felt like I came to the crossroads of get busy living or get busy dying, and chose to get busy living and pay forward some of the things that I learned on my journey. Could you talk a little more about the term embracing the suck, like what that means in terms of living with cancer? And then how do you pay forward what you've experienced and what you've learned?
Yeah, I think embracing the suck is just getting to a point in your life where you realize you don't have much control over this. When I was in college, I went to a military college in South Carolina. And for 1 year, one of the individual who was the president was a man by the name of James Stockdale. Now, that may not ring a bell for either one of you, but I'm old enough to remember he was an admiral in the Navy. He was shot down in his A4 over Vietnam. And he was the highest ranking prisoner of war at the Hanoi Hilton, and actually was a Medal of Honor winner based on what he did to resist the Vietnamese. When Ross Perot ran for president of the United States, he picked Stockdale to be his vice presidential running mate. And I remember being in a meeting with Stockdale, and somebody asked him, you know, who made it out of the Hanoi Hilton? Who made it out of this horrible prisoner of war camp? And he had an interesting answer to that. He said, you know, it was not the big, tough, strong guys that, you know, the sort of, I'll use the term muscle heads. He didn't use that. That's mine. You know, these guys that, you know, hey, I'm tough and stuff like this. Those guys didn't make it. They didn't. Even the optimists, the people who, you know what, we're going to be rescued by Christmas and things like that, or we're going to be out of here by Christmas. And then Christmas would come and they weren't rescued and they weren't let go. And those people would get depressed and they would die. He said the people that made it through were the people that realized and controlled the things that they could control. And he said for us, it was basically our thoughts and our breathing. Those are the only two things that we had any control over. And when you start to realize that when you have cancer and things like that, there's very little that's within your control. You know, how this plays out, but how you attack it, how what your attitude is toward it, is really the difference between somebody that's successful, quote unquote, and somebody that's not, somebody that just gives up and gives in to this helplessness and hopelessness. So, you know, it's all about what you can control. And when I coached high school basketball, I used to tell my players that the only thing you can control is your attitude and your effort out on the court. Everything else is up to chance. You might have a great game and score 40 points. You may not hit the broadside of a barn. The referees may foul you out. Whatever it is, what you can control, understand that and control it. The rest of it, just realize it's outside of your purview. Hmm.
I think that's such a good lens, and what you've just described could be applied to a slew of problems that we see with first responders or just in people's personal lives, you know, whether you're approaching an illness or divorce or death of a spouse or all the multitude of issues that happen in life. I think what you're gleaning from that is so powerful and so inspiring. And I think the people listening today can draw something from that for their own life. Just to go back a little bit, you had mentioned a story about Johns Hopkins and rats treading water. I'm really, really curious about the details of that story.
Sure. So I try to stay away from the rat story because depending on how who the audience is, the rats.
Well, we always go right for the gritty point.
The good stuff, right? The blood and guts. So I guess maybe I should step back a little bit and let people understand. I mean, you're looking at me right now. There's no S on my chest. I don't wear a cape and fly around with magical powers. I'm a human being. I have bad days. You know, there are days I feel down. There are days I cry. There are days I feel sorry for myself. Sure. But when I do, I remember two stories. And one of them is the rat story. And the other one kind of dovetails into that. And I remember reading about this professor back in the 1950s at Johns Hopkins University who took rats, very simple experiment. He put rats in water that were over their head. And he wanted to see how long the average rat could tread water before it would sink and drown. And the average rat initially treaded water for about 15 minutes. And just as those rats were getting ready to drown, he reached in, grabbed them, pulled them out, dried them off, and let them rest for a while. And then he put those exact same rats in that exact same tank of water. And the second time around, on average, those rats treaded water for 60 hours. So think about that. First time, 15 minutes. I'm just not going to fail. I'm going to die. My life is going to be over. Second time around, 60 hours, which taught me two things. Number one, the importance of hope in our lives. We have to believe that maybe not this week, maybe not next month, maybe not even next year, but at some point in time, our life is going to get better. And the second thing is just how much more our bodies can handle physically than we ever thought they could. Now, I've always believed there, you know, we all have sort of that point where we're done. We just can't go on. But that point is so much further down the road than we ever thought it would be. So that's kind of the rat story. And then the other story that dovetails with it is my wife actually works with a young man who's a former Navy SEAL. And he is very kind. On my off weeks, he calls me just to check up on me and see how I'm doing. And we talk about what the SEALs call their 40% rule, which basically says if you're at the end of your rope, you can't go on, you don't think you can, you know, put one more foot in front of the other, that you're only at 40% of your maximum and you still have another 60% left in reserve to give to yourself. So whenever I get into those dark spaces, I always remember those two stories. And for me, at least, it kind of helps me to continue to move forward.
Yeah. I have a good friend who's a Marine, and he says when it got so bad you wanted to quit, you have to dig deep. And that's his mantra that he's taught me. So there are times where I struggle or I'm overwhelmed with something, and I think of my friend, and I think if those guys can do it, I can do it too. I can figure it out somehow, and I dig deep. They're valuable lessons. And you know, I was wondering too, you have all these wonderful ideas, your principles, sayings, things like that. I know that you've written a book and wanted you to talk a little bit about that book and how it came to be.
Yeah, the book is called Sustainable Excellence, The 10 Principles for Leading Your Uncommon and Extraordinary Life. And the book is really born out of two conversations I had. One was with a former player who had moved to Colorado, where my wife and I live with her fiance, and the four of us had dinner one night. And I remember after dinner saying to her, you know, I'm really excited that you're living close and I can watch you find and live your purpose. And she got real quiet for a while. And then she looked at me and she said, well, coach, what do you think my purpose is? I said, I have no idea what your purpose is, but that's what your life should be about, finding the reason you were put on the face of this earth and living that reason. So that was one conversation. And then I had a young man in college reach out to me on social media, and he asked me what I thought were the most important things he should learn to not just be successful in his job or in business, but to be successful in life. And I didn't want to give him the, you know, get up early, work hard, help others. Not that those aren't important. Those are incredibly important. But I wanted to see if I could go deeper with him. So I took some time, and I used to walk around with a pad and paper in my hand, and or a pad of paper and a pencil in my hand. And I started to take these notes. And eventually I had, you know, sort of these 10 thoughts, these 10 ideas, these 10 principles. And so I sent them to him. And then I stepped back and I was like, well, you know, I got a life story that fits underneath this principle, or I know somebody whose life emulates that principle. So literally during the 3-month period where I was healing after I had my leg amputated, I sat down at the computer every day and I built stories, and they're real stories about real people underneath each of the principles. And that's how Sustainable Excellence came to be.
Hmm. And where can people find the book? Tell us a little bit about that. And also love to know some of the other things you're doing out there with motivational speaking and classes, things like that.
Yeah, you can get Sustainable Excellence anywhere you can get a book online, Amazon, BarnesandNoble.com, Apple iBooks, pretty much anywhere online you get a book, you can get Sustainable Excellence. I made the brilliant business decision to start a motivational speaking business right as COVID started. So that nobody should take business advice from me whatsoever. But people started to read the book and hear me on podcasts. And that was kind of, you know, like everybody else, we had to figure out a different way. I mean, not so much first responders. I mean, we still had to do what we had to do. But for people in business and that, it's like, how am I going to deliver my product or my service in a way that is going to be different now that COVID hit? And I was thinking the same thing. And somebody reached out to me and said, would you like to be a guest on my podcast? And my response was, what's a podcast? I had absolutely no idea what a podcast was. They explained it to me, and I said, sure, I'd be happy to do it. And I did a podcast yesterday with a former NFL player who told me, said, when I started my podcast, I was scared to death. He said, I had no idea what I was doing. And I said, I felt the same way when I was a guest on the podcast. I had notes all around my camera, you know, and they'd ask me a question. And I'd be like, okay, the answer to that is, and you know, and it was so, I was terrible. I was terrible at it. But it's eventually the more you do it, the better you get at it. And now I've been very fortunate to be on, you know, probably 500 podcasts around the world with different people talking about a lot of the same stuff. But I've never had a bad experience. People have been amazing throughout this whole situation. So I started, people started to hear me and then said, you know, we'd like you to put a membership program together. And I was like, oh, I mean, with my treatments and stuff, I don't know if I really want to do that. But eventually I did. And I just started the Sustainable Excellence membership in June. So it's really still kind of in its infancy, but people are starting to come on board. It's on-demand videos. It's a community, a closed community where like-minded leaders and professionals can kind of, you know, bounce things off each other and stuff like that. And I learned a lot from these people as well. So it's been a lot of fun for me.
Great. And how can people find you on the internet or social media?
So my blog is Motivational Check. So motivationalcheck.com will get you to me. You can leave me a message there. You can actually get access to the book. I do have recommendations for videos to watch, other books to read. My podcast that I've been on are on there as well. And you can also get access to the Sustainable Excellence membership on motivationalcheck.com.
That's great. You know, I was laughing when you said you were terrible in the beginning. I think David and I know the feeling. It's like over time you polish, you get better.
You do. Yeah, I mean,
you got to put in those 10,000 hours.
I had nowhere to go but up. I was so terrible. It was just like, oh my gosh. I was like, no, I don't even want to put that up.
Well, we're blessed to have you when you've put in the hours to get to the place you are now, which is an incredibly inspiring and interesting guest, and so much good stuff you're putting out there in the world, Terry. So thank you for all you do, and thank you for being with us on the show.
Well, thank you, David. Thank you, Bonnie. I appreciate it. And hopefully we're going to make a positive difference in somebody's life.
Thank you, Terry. We will. And you already have today. So thank you.
I'd like to remind everybody to like, subscribe, comment on YouTube, Responder Resilience, on Facebook, Responder Wellness Inc., bbsradio.com, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and our website is respondertv.com. Catch all the previous episodes and see the guest information. Till the next time, stay safe, be kind to yourself. Take care.